this past year we've been talking about how God debunks ancient theories and myths through stories in the Torah, and you know, you can't just go into a world where child sacrifice is the norm and all of a sudden tell people, well, you know, we shouldn't be child sacrificing our children, so just stop. Right? A world where Gilui Arayos is the order of the day and women are subject to horrific sexual abuse. You can't just say, okay, that's wrong. Who's going to listen? This has to be a great strategy of how we show that those things are wrong and how to turn the corner on them. Well, you spent the whole year working on this. So I've been working with the Parsha. I want to work with Parsha's Baloscha on this, because Baloscha is a very, perhaps the most disparate Parsha in the Torah. If you look, it's a very large Parsha, right? It starts off with the menorah, then the initiation of the Leviim, right? And their workings as God's chosen tribe. Then we have the question of Pesach Sheni, of the Jews who couldn't offer the Passover sacrifice because they were impure. Then you have all of the descriptions of how the Jews traveled in the desert from the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. Then you have a description of the trumpets that blasted out for the joyful days, on the sorrowful days. It's probably there also because it's talking about the journeys. Remember, they expected to be in Israel in just a few days. So Moshe's going to blow his trumpets and we're going to walk in tandem. Right? So we have the description of the trumpets. Then we have how each of the tribes lined up with their head of their tribe. Then Moshe asks Yisro to come with them. And he tells them, we're going right into Israel. Come with us. And then the roof falls in. People kvetch, the misonanim, the asafsuf, the Erev Rav, they started to complain about all the food they had, the bad food that they were eating. Come on, you're about to go into Israel. Come on, a land flowing with milk and honey. You're going to be there in just a few days. Why complain about the moment? But that's where they were. And they kvetched. And then Moshe's reaction there was problematic, to say the least. Rashi says that when Moshe hit the rock, later in Parshas Chukas, towards the end of the 40 years in the desert, that it says in the Torah that that's what God told him why he couldn't go into Israel. But Rashi says Moshe's fate was sealed here in this Parsha, when he complained about the people complaining. They complained, and then Moshe went up to God and said, God, did I give birth to these people? Am I responsible for these people? Right? So Rashi says the reason why God didn't tell him then that he couldn't go into Israel is because that was at least private. Right? Moshe didn't complain publicly about that. Well, Moshe had the rock, it was quite public. So Moshe said, I need help. And God said, okay, I'm going to give you help. Choose 70 elders. What exactly these 70 elders were there to do? Because Moshe had elders earlier. And Sefer Shmos, Moshe works with elders. Right? So, okay, that's for a different time. It's not related to our topic. But there are two elders that fall out, Eldad Umedad. And there's a bit of a story there about Moshe being told to silence them. And then after that, we have the story of Miriam speaking against her brother and his family, his wife choices and his family life. That's the parasha. I mean, this is, what is all this about? Where does one thing lead to another? So I'm not in the habit of quoting Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev, but he cites a very nice connection. He weaves a tapestry where there is a thread that is woven between each one of these stories that deals with either communication with God or a manifestation of God. Communication through the Leviim and their song and their conduit between the people and God. What communication is the Pesach Sheni story? One of the most important communications in Judaism, the Shaila, the question. They truly wanted, it's very hot in here, I'm going to take off my jacket. They truly wanted to observe the Pesach sacrifice and the Pesach holiday and thought they couldn't because they were in a state of ritual impurity. So that, there's no greater communication than that. What does God want us to do, right? So that's the question. The other manifestation of God is the, with the fire and the cloud, right? The chatzotros, the trumpets, is also a communication with God, right? We use the trumpets to communicate a message from God to the people. Okay, the misonanim. There's no worse kind of communication than kvetching, except what comes at the end of the parasha, which is lashon hara. Okay, the slander of Miriam against her brother. What exactly that slander was, maybe if there's time at the end, we'll discuss. But it goes a little beyond our message here today. So here is the point. In the ancient world, gods did not communicate with the people directly. They communicated only with their high priest or their king, or something of that sort. And then that king communicated the message to everyone else. Islam has one prophet, and then that prophet who communicates with God communicates it down to everyone else. Right? Even the events we discussed this one last week, the week before, but the seminal event in Christianity is the rising from the grave. But that's only seen by one woman. Not even his disciples. A woman. A screaming woman who claims that she saw some kind of an apparition and they went to check the grave and he wasn't there. So that is something about communication only with a choice few, a choice even one. As opposed to Judaism, where God communicates throughout the Bible, but especially in the Torah, of course, he starts with a certain conduit. The Gemara refers to them as the chariot of God. The Merkava is with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, right? And then through Moshe to the entire nation, right? Now, God is not to be seen, of course, so no one experienced an actual sense data of God, but God made a revelation, something that was revealed to people. Miracles were revealed to them, open miracles, right? It's hard to pull a hoax on an entire nation, right? Someone could have come forth just out of nowhere and told a small group of people, listen, let's try to convince everybody in the nation that God did these miracles in front of 3 million people. They'll accept it. Of course they wouldn't. Why would it take to the 19th century for the reform movement to question these things? People should have questioned it a long time ago. The answer is they had a very firm, strong tradition that was passed on from generation to generation. I like to say that the way I know that Egyptian exodus took place is the same way I know that the survivors of the Holocaust lived to tell their story. Many Jews died in Egypt. Many Jews died in the Holocaust. The people who died were not able to pass on what they had seen and experienced to anybody else. They died. But they were survivors. And those survivors told other people what they saw. Not to mention that the people who committed these atrocities actually took pictures and films of it. Right? So they saw these things and they told their children. I wouldn't have needed to see any single picture or read any book to know certain events of the Holocaust. Now, when I say I know Yetzias Mitzrayim happened, I say that I know it happened for the same reason that the Holocaust happened. Because my father told me. And my father was never in Egypt, and he certainly wasn't a slave in Egypt. But he was told about that by his father. His father did not tell him about the Holocaust. His father was killed in the Holocaust. His father didn't have to tell him. But generations and generations have been passing down these stories. But the original stories show how different Judaism is from the ancient Near East. Because this is fascinating. Because everything the gods want to impart to their people is imparted only directly to a very choice few, usually only one person. So you're going to say, wait a second, Judaism too? God imparted it to Moses, and that's it. right? No one else besides Moses got to go up to the mountain. True enough, but what Moshe was taught was immediately, the parsha right after the experience of Sinai says, "Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tosim lifnehem," shall place these statutes in front of the people. This is Judaism, the ancient Israelite revelation distinguishes itself because it was meant to be experienced and shared, that's important, shared by the populace at large. You're going to find, so what? Ho-hum. Not so what. Look at ancient codes. Look at the introduction to the Code of Hammurabi. Egyptian and Sumerian codes are not for the masses. They're not for the populace. They're not even to be studied or even known by the populace. We just give you the laws in general and you know, how are we supposed to follow the laws if we don't read them? No, the general law is don't cause damage. Simple, don't cause damage. Right? Now the Torah has Parashas Mishpatim. Not only do we have a written law, we have oral law. Right? We have the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Yerushalmi, the Bavli, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, the Torah. You know, we have all these codes and so much that everybody is charged to know. Not like the introduction to the Code of Hammurabi. This is just for me and my high priest, and everybody else shall just know generalities. No. No. That's why it's so hard to be a rabbi. Everybody's a lawyer in my community. Right? And you're supposed to know family law and tort law and business law and partnership law and bankruptcy law and divorce law and mortgage law. And you're supposed to know ritual. Everything is part of the law. Right? You're supposed to study Bava Kamma, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, Sanhedrin. You're supposed to know how to construct the Sanhedrin. You're supposed to know how to administer punishments. Who does that? Who goes to law school if you're not going to practice law? Right? So the Torah says, "Ve'ele mishpatim asher tosim lifneihem." I want you to know it all, everybody, to the extent with which you can. Okay? So God communicates to us through His Torah. His Torah is the communication. Right? So in Parshas Baloscha, he starts off with the menorah. Now, as I'm talking, try to figure out why the menorah is part of this. What's the menorah has to do with this? Every other story, I just mentioned 9 other parts of the parsha that relate to different types of communication. I'm going to elaborate on them now. And try to figure out, where does the menorah fit in with this? What on earth does the menorah have to do with any of this? Okay? To start with. Originally, God's message was to be communicated through each and every family. Every family's firstborn was supposed to be the communicator. But because of the worship of the golden calf, that communicator ideal went not to each family, but to the only tribe that didn't worship that idol. As it says that the entire tribe of Levi was drawn to Moshe. Okay. So Moshe then was told by God to make a change from the Bechor to the Levi. Okay, and our parsha discusses the activities of the Levi. Basically, the Levi's job is simple. They are the ministers to the Kohanim and the ministers to the people. This is why they live in the cities of refuge. Because in the cities of refuge, you have a lot of hot-headed people. People who killed by mistake. People who might be running after them. So the Levim will calm down those hotheads. Okay? Levim do not get land of their own. They live in the midst of all the other tribes. Okay? Their occupation is to work in the temple. They are guardians of the gates. They are the singers, right? And in return, they get maaser rishon. They get a tenth of everybody's crops. disputes of which crops they're supposed to get, according to the Torah, but everybody agrees that rabbinically they get all kinds of crops, fruits, vegetables, grains, legumes, okay? So a tenth of everybody's crops going to some Levi or another covers everybody pretty much, right? Levi was a small tribe. And what's interesting is that, just parenthetically, since the Parsha mentions Levium, at the end of the Tanakh, Ezra points out that the Levium went AWOL. Levium did not return from the exile with the Kohanim. You say he looked for Levium, he couldn't find any. Okay? This explains an interesting phenomenon. Tell me if anybody listening now is familiar with this phenomenon. I see it in my show, I see it in Daily Minyan. Is at this time of the Torah, there were 22,300 Levium. 22,300 Levium. How many Kohanim?
3.
Aaron, Elazar, Itamar. Maybe Pinchas was probably around already, right? So there are 22,300 Levium and 3 Kohanim. Already by the time of Ezra, those numbers profoundly split and switched, because there were many more Kohanim then than Levium. I understand that. Kohanim tend to guard their lineage much more than Levium do. But my experience, like today in Shul, we had a Kohen, but no Levi. Right? I'm usually not out in the hallway at the time, but I'm pretty sure that when the Kohanim are washing their hands to bless the people, that there are usually more Kohanim than Levium washing their hands. Okay, be that as it may, the Levium here are the singers, right? Mishorim. They're Shoarim. They're the gatekeepers. Lots of gates. At the time of the temple, but now they're the guardians of the Ohel Moed. And they just serve to minister to the needs of the Kohanim. Okay. So, but they're mostly identified with something we say each and every day at the end of davening. Anybody want to help me with that? Hayom Yom Sheni Bashabbos, Shebo Hayu Halaviyim Omrim Beis Hamikdash. Okay, so this is the. Anyone wants to unmute themselves? So these are the word. These are the song that the Levium used to sing in the temple. So that's their communication through song. Pesach Sheni involves one of the most important modes of communication, especially for a rabbi, which is the Shiloh. Right? After all, a rabbi has a lot of goals, a lot of purposes, a lot of missions. But isn't the main mission to answer the questions, to answer the difficult questions, right? To be there for the halacha questions, right? That seems to be the most important thing Moshe does, is to answer their questions. Like in Parshas Yisro, when he was standing from morning to night, dealing with the people's problems. Okay. Next we have the chatzotros, the trumpets. Okay, in 1970, I believe the only time that Israel took out the trumpets have to be made of pure silver, and they must be blown by a Kohen. So, the problem with that is that a Kohen today, we don't know which Kohanim are directly descended from Aaron. And in order to do this mitzvah, you have to know that you're a Kohen. But, all right, we took one of the most reliable Kohanim, and he blew trumpets in 1970 because there was some attrition from Jordan, and they were afraid that it was going to be another war. But of course, the no war happened in 1970 because they blew the trumpets. Okay, all right. So these trumpets is a way to communicate our feelings to God. Who needs trumpets? Just pray. Right, Kamash Malon. That's what the shofar does in Rosh Hashanah. Right. There was a reform shul in the United States that in the early part of the 20th century that decided, hey, we're going to do better than the shofar. They just had a woman crying. Instead of the shofar, they had a woman crying. Because the Gemara says the shofar is supposed to sound like a woman crying. Right? Yavava, trua, is a cry. So we're not good at this woman crying. So we do both. Right? So why bother with the shofar? Just have the real thing. Okay, so the Chatzal Trus is somewhat similar to the Levian. We sometimes can communicate to God through sound, the sound of waves of song or waves of trumpet blasts. Okay? Next we have two examples of the worst kind of communication, which is kvetching. Said they were tired of this man, right? Now, how long had they been eating this man? By this time, it's been about a year. Okay, I could consider, you know, eating the same old thing each and every day for a year, three times a day, or twice a day. I'm still getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, but okay. So, eating this thing. And only this thing. So Chazal tell us that it had the taste of whatever you wanted it to taste like. Okay, these are traditions. Let's accept the Kabbalah. But, you know, the people just wanted a change. It looked the same. Okay? But the Gemara in the Seches Yuma, but the Psukim seem to say that there were different ways to prepare it. Okay. But they complained. Now, complaints are acceptable, as long as you complain properly. When Bnei Yisrael complained in Parshas Bishalach that they had no water, that was a justifiable complaint. You're thirsty, your throat is parched, and you feel you need to have water, right? When Avram makes his way to Israel, and there's a famine there, and he runs out of Israel right away. So Ramban says that's a sign that he failed the test. God was testing him of whether he would stay. Rashi says, no, I disagree sharply with any such statement. Rashi says, Rashi of course is before Ramban, Rashi says that the test was to see if Avram would complain. The fact that he went to Egypt without complaining is a sign that Avram passed that test. Okay? So the complaints of the people in Parshas and Pashas Baloscha is Moshe's undoing. And I have to ask a question here. Moshe lived through some very, very serious threats to his leadership. Korach and Shlach and Chukas, for goodness sakes, everywhere you go, and back in Shmos a number of places. Moshe in none of them reacts with the hopelessness of our parsha. It's a strong question. What made Moshe in this parsha react? He didn't react that way with the Meraglim. He didn't react that way with the Egel. He didn't react that way in any of the other threats that the Bnei Israel made to him. Any other, revolts against Moshe and his leadership. Right? In this parsha, Moshe just says, God, did I give birth to them? Why did you make me their leader? Am I supposed to do everything for them? Right? So here's how I might explain this. In all the other stories where Bnei Israel rebelled against God and against Moshe, it could be a logical argument that someone could give, someone with Moshe's intellectual prowess and prophetic prowess, knowing that he has the proper ideology of how God should be presented, that he can argue with the people of why the Egel is wrong. Of course, Moshe there used more than just the argument. He used his staff and his miraculous charge of the situation. Right? But in every single case, although in some Moshe reacts by simply falling on his face with an immediate array of silence, but in every case, if Moshe had to, he could defend the situation and show why you're behaving wrong. But let me tell you this. In our story, which begins, Vayit'avu ta'ava. Vayit'avu ta'ava. That's the misonim. That Moshe can't fight with. What does it mean, Vayit'avu ta'ava? It means that they inculcated a desire. Right? People listening to these words right now may have a desire. I'm pretty thirsty right now, so I would desire would like a nice, see what would be a nice drink right now. Just a nice tall glass of water would be nice, right? So that is a desire. But you know what? I see 15 minutes left of class. I'm doing fine. Sometimes some people listening may be hungry. You haven't had a bite since lunch. When is he going to be finished? So I go, well, you can get lunch, get a bite right now while I'm talking to you. I'm sorry, it's not from Alan Nussbaum's stuff, but you have to get your own stuff. But you're hungry, all right, satisfy your hunger. You know, you're supposed to have good things in your house, good wholesome ways to satisfy midnight hungers. Right? Best thing to do is just to take a little water or something, but okay. I think what works also, I have these ginger snaps in my house. It's candied ginger, no calories. But boy, it makes you not want to eat for the next 2 hours. If you eat a little bit of that. Anyway, so if you're disciplined, whatever you have a desire for, you'll be able to put off that fulfillment of that desire. Right? Especially if the desire is something that you know you shouldn't have. Right? We all have urges, but we also have inhibitions. What drives those inhibitions? I don't want to get caught, I don't want to get ashamed, I don't want to get browbeaten, I don't want to get fined, I don't want... Or you can just hopefully get to the madrigal where you say it's just wrong. I don't want to do it, it's just wrong. Even when no one's looking. So to reach the stage in the other opposite direction, the dichotomous direction of a yit'avu ta'avah, not just that a desire comes to you, so I'm going to fulfill it. The religious person is raised pushing off desire. The six-year-old child who wants ice cream is told you can't because your fleshix is being raised with great, great temperance and forbearance. Necessary building blocks of a religious life is to be able to say no. How we brave in an animal? Because we can say no. We say oyin. Instead of mosara, no, the bema. What way is an animal better than an animal is oyin. We don't have to say no. That's the most important part. So that we can pretend forestall that enjoyment. But the people, Vayit'avu ta'ava, they inculcate enjoyment. Right? The first time anyone tastes whiskey, you think they like it? Right? How often was it? Maybe an irresponsible elder gave this 13-year-old a shot of whiskey. Won't be taught. You can become addicted to anything at any age, right? Preferably, someone should get their first taste of whiskey a little older age. But there are people I know who love whiskey like it's a certain single malt scotches. That I know how much they're worth because I sell their chametz on Pesach, and they say, "Oh, I'm selling $30,000 of scotch," right? So, and that's just about six bottles. Anyway, but and they enjoy it because that's called an addiction. They enjoy it because because they're addicted to it. But the very first time they liked it, what caused that? What made that happen? They didn't like the taste of the whiskey. They liked what it did to them afterwards. Right? And then they started taking it more and more. I want to know, at what age does whiskey start tasting better than apple juice? Since they look the same in a cup. Right? At what age? At 3? At 7? At 10? At 18? At 42? At what? Right? Brain gets high over lack of... what's the last word? Oxygen. Okay. So of course, they like what it does to them. All right? So this is why Moshe lost it when it came to the Mishnah in the Vayit Avutah. But those are two different stories. So the Kvetchers kvetched because they didn't have the things that they loved, that they wanted, right? Okay, so Vayitavu Tava means that I can't fight with that. I can't argue with Vayitavu Tava, because that's the antithesis of what God taught me about what the Torah is. The Torah says that here's a loving married couple, but they're going to put off their desire to be intimate for some time. I want to have this food, but I can't, either because it's not kosher, I haven't tithed it yet, I just had, I'm not fleshes, or whatever the thing is, right? As much as I, and the more you want to have it, the more the reward for not taking it. So that's why Moshe loses it when it comes to the kvetching. And then, I'm skipping over the next one. Even if Aaron and Miriam meant well with their discussion about their brother and their brother's wife, they meant well. What should they have done? Yeah. They should have gone straight to Moshe. Maybe the two of them together. Listen, Moshe, we love you. We are siblings. We care very much about you. We care very much about your wife. Right? The six of us used to do barbecues together. I don't know. Whatever. We care very much about your wife. And is there anything we can do? Instead, they talk to each other. Okay? Okay, I'm trying to unmute everybody. Allow everybody to unmute.
Ah, there. Perfect.
Okay. Okay, good. All right, so now no? How about now?
Okay, no, it's perfect.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you for that.
All right, so then, so Miriam's Lashon Hara about Moshe was not just about Moshe's wife. I mean, in the Pshat, she talks about Yishak Hushit Asher Lakach. Rashi and Ramban and Ibn Ezra are of the opinion that Yishak Hushit means Tzipora. There's a good biblical reference to this because there's a place called Kushan. Kushan, which in Sefer Chavakuk, and not Torah, just now, of Rosh Chodesh, of Shavuos, second day Shavuos, Chavakuk speaks about Kushan and Midian being side by side and are used in parallel terms. So an Isha Kushit may be a Midianite woman, right? Not an Ethiopian woman, that would be way down south in Africa. But a Kushit could be a Midianite woman, referring to Tzipora in a derogatory way because she wasn't an Israelite. That's why at the end of Bamidbar, Moshe couldn't speak out against the Midianite trespasses, right? Because if he had done so, someone might have said, "And who permitted your Midianite woman?" Right? Moshe was not married to someone born to the Israelite people, right? Okay, and Miriam and Aharon and Pshat spoke about that. Now, that's, I don't know, Tzipora is considered a very righteous woman like Ruth in our literature, at least, and she saved Moshe's life in the beginning of Shmos. There's no reason to think that Moshe and Aaron were against her. No. Moreover, they loved her. What they didn't like is, yeah, anybody?
Amelia? Once. They were speaking on her behalf because Moshe separated himself from her. And they felt they're also prophets, and he's a prophet. So why is he doing that to his wife? Because
what gives you the right to consider that you don't have any conjugal obligations to your wife, like relationships that we maintain? What makes you so special? So you see, it wasn't just Lashon Hara about the way Moshe was treating his wife; it was Lashon Hara about Moshe's prophecy and prophetic abilities, right? So if you really believe this, then call it out and talk to him about this, right? This was just in the Daf Yomi just a few days ago, right? So when Moshe realized that he had to leave his obligations, it was probably much earlier on in the beginning of Shmos when he was returning to Egypt with his wife, and there was that near tragic death at the hands of the angels, or that angel that came to him. All right, so he realized then that he's so close to God who comes to him at any moment, and he better be ready. So Moshe and Aaron didn't realize how much greater Moshe, Aaron and Miriam didn't realize how much greater Moshe was, which is why the text refers to him as a humble man right afterwards. If Moshe wasn't so humble, he would have told them every Monday and Thursday how close he is with God and how often God comes to him and how he has to be so careful. You know, he wasn't interested in talking that way, right? Now, admittedly, Rashbam says that the Shakushit is Pshat. Rashbam is the best, greatest Pashtan of all. And he says Yishakushit means an Ethiopian woman. Have you ever heard of a tradition Rashbam mentions from an apocryphal work known as Divrei HaYamim de Moshe? It's a midrashic work about Moshe's life during the time that he left Egypt until he got to Midian. Right? According to some of Farshim, it was quite a few years there. He didn't go straight to Midian. Okay? And in between, he married an Ethiopian princess. And when, after the Yetzias Mitzrayim story was over, remember, that was his first love. Right? That was his first wife. Tzipora was his second wife. On his way home, he came and met back up with an Ethiopian wife. And she accompanied him. And Miriam didn't like it. Okay? It would then be, see, Lashon Hara is punished by Tzaraas. It makes sense. It makes sense, because what does Lashon Hara do? It usually reveals something that's not meant to be revealed. Right? It reveals something not meant to be revealed. So what should be the punishment? So something on your skin gets to be revealed. Right? Who knows where the tzaraas is? It might be in a place that's not usually revealed. Some young Kohen is going to have to look at it and purify it. Right? So Lashon Hara becomes the appropriate punishment for... tzaraas becomes the appropriate punishment for Lashon Hara. But in Miriam's case, it's especially appropriate because her Lashon Hara had to do with skin color. Right? Okay, we're somewhere between black and white. So she spoke about someone being black, so she punished her by turning white. Right? So that's how Lashon Hara fits in, and that's the worst of all communications. Now, Chevra, we end where we began. How does the menorah fit in? All these modes of communication, the Levium singing, the Shaila of Pesach Sheni, the symbolism of the Eish and Anav, the songs of the Chatotros, the kvetching of the Misonanim, the prophecy of Elder Medad, the Lashon Hara of Miriam, all different types of communication, good and bad. The menorah is a human face. Look at everyone's face. We all have three sets of receptacles. Ears, eyes, the nostrils, right? Two nostrils, two eyes, two ears that communicate, that take in the communications, right? Senses, everything from outside that brings it into the person, right? And what's the one? We only get one of those because the middle of the menorah has just one strand, right? The mouth is the shamas. You get it? Mouth, two ears, two eyes, two nostrils, okay? The menorah is purposely put in Parshas Balamscha, because it's that element and that symbol of communication. So if it says what we take in, or the senses we draw into the body, let the mind process it and then put it into the mouth to send out in a good way, not a negative way. Okay? Clever, that is our share for the evening. And I hope that everyone is staying safe and staying well. It looks like the city is soon going to ease some of our restrictions. I do look forward very much to the day we'll be able to be back in the Beis Medrash on Monday nights for this year. And we miss all of you, and I hope that everyone has a good night.
Shkach.
Bye, Rabbi.